Yeah, it's going. We'll put it up here on paper. That'll be good.
All right, so we're talking now about our new topic, which is selection, the idea of actually selecting people to be part of your goal achievement strategy from a human resources point of view. Now, remember, we're at time one, trying to get to the goal there at time two, right? And we need to have people with maybe some slightly modified or greatly modified skills. We may need to have more people, all kinds of changes to HR that we're going to have to make in order to help the company achieve its goals. And, of course, as you well remember, the slightest inefficiency means that we achieve our goal at some later point in time, and that, therefore, competition creeps in, we lose money, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a sign-in sheet? Cool. Be sure the date's on there, 3 o'clock class, and that there's numbers running down the side. Good. All right, so what we need then is that we now know the laws, and we can be careful about not offending any of the laws as we enter into our selection mode or discussion, as the case may be. We have then this idea of selection being a person for a job. A person for a job. And as simple as it looks there, we are well aware of the fact that this is often done incorrectly. And as you can imagine, you have seen many people that do a very poor job of what they're doing. And so I'll ask you, why is this connection so difficult to make accurately? What knowledge are you missing? What things do you use to make judgments that are inaccurate, et cetera, et cetera? What are the problems here in this job-to-person fit? There's 32 people in the class. There appears to be 4 missing. So that's, what, 10, 12%? It's going to be close, but I think it's okay. I'm shooting for 20, but if it's, I don't care. I like to punish the other kids anyway. So what's the problem here? Why isn't this done correctly? If I said, you, is this guy good for the job? That's all I'm telling you. Is he good for the job? What are you going to say? Thank you. And where are you going to get that information? Information about A, the person, and B, the job, right? Okay. Where do you get the information about the job? Online. Online, you guys.
Your superiors, people above you.
We already talked about this for a lecture at least.
Job analysis.
Job analysis, job specifications, and job descriptions, right? So we would take that information and we would use it to assess the person. What would we try to avoid when assessing the person?
Bias.
Biases, right? That make you put a big halo or a big heart around that individual when really they're clearly not the right person for the job. And if you don't know it now, you'll know it in some period of time on into the future when things are not going very well. Okay. So what we need to do then is to eliminate biases in our viewing of the person, right? We get rid of biases, and we use all possible information from the job analysis, job description, and job specifications that are available to us as much as possible. Well, you already know about all the biases, right? You had that in OB, remember? Okay, prove it. Name some of them.
Gender?
Not that kind of bias. The bias that makes you see someone inaccurately.
It could be like your friend or your relative.
Which is called? Nepotism. Oh, yeah, nepotism, I guess. But if they're a friend, you like them, right? For what reason? Give me some biases that Jackie told you about or somebody told you about. Joe, what the hell? Who told you? Who took your OB class? Who taught your OB classes?
Not sure.
Brian's great. He told you all this stuff. What kind of biases are you trying to get rid of? Central tendency.
Yeah.
You would group all the people sort of about the same. What else? There's a golden halo around their head. Halo bias, damn it. What else you got? Contrast bias, where a bunch of really lousy people come in, you know, all the Clemson applicants come along, and then all of a sudden there's an ASU candidate, and you just flip out. This person looks so grand. Okay. Like me bias, right? A person has a lot of similarities to you. Same background, likes the same football team, blah, 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 blah. That would be another form of bias. Right?
Has so an Eagles license plate.
Eagles license plate would be a like me bias, no question about it. Even looked a little bit like me. Kind of ratty. So we have all these biases that screen us from being able to see a person accurately. We want to get rid of those and see that person with a clear and crystal view of what they can and can't do. And what they can and can't do, our judgments are going to be based on testing, selection testing. So we're going to talk now at some length about the concept of selection testing. Tests that are put in place to help you pick your new employees. Have all of you applied for a job where you had to take some form of selection test? And were there any stupid questions that you had to respond to?
There's a lot of questions.
Boy, are there a lot. Where do you see yourself in 10 years? That has to be about the dumbest question known to mankind. Let's see, what else would be really up there? Almost any kind of psychological test is pretty far out there in terms of dumb. Let's see, what else do they have? References are really even a little suspect. We'll talk about references a good bit. What did you have, paper and pencil tests? Were you? Okay, but I mean, same thing.
Yeah.
Was it a sort of answer questions about yourself or what others thought about you?
It had everything from, like, your past jobs, and it even had questions for, like, can you count? And it would be, like, John has 3 apples, he buys 3 apples, how many does he have? For, like, jobs. They just want to make sure you can count anything.
Well, lucky I didn't get that one.
Yeah.
So what we have, then, is this attempt by employers now to screen out using these absurd selection processes. So what I want to talk to you about is the concept of validity. The concept of validity means the concept of accuracy. Is a test actually helpful toward getting your best employees, which means that the test has to have a high degree of validity. The higher the validity, the better. Now you might ask yourself, what's one of the major criteria for your college professors? All of us have what?
A doctorate.
A doctorate. Okay, does that mean we're good teachers?
No.
In our doctorate programs, I've never seen a doctorate program where we actually had to be graded on teaching. Yes, we teach. We go into the classroom and harangue other students, we being a student ourselves, right? But nobody gives us any feedback on this. So you kind of wonder, doesn't it? Is it really reasonable to figure that PhDs are going to be good teachers? The answer is probably not. And at certain schools, they're certainly not. I had a student at Virginia Tech tell me that I was the first professor in her 4 years there that ever called her by her name, which I thought was kind of interesting. My son went to Chapel Hill, and he communicated with one of his professors by writing notes and sticking them on the door, and then the professor would scrawl a note on the door and put it back there and close his door. He was in there, but he wouldn't talk to you. So he communicated by written notes stuck on his door. Now, there's a good teaching process.
Wow.
That's what I say, too. Pretty weird. But anyway, so you wonder about whether or not that's a good selection process. But the only thing about PhDs, we know a lot, believe it or not, at least at some point in our careers. So what we're trying to do is develop valid tests, an accurate test toward future job performance. However, we can't step into that pool too quickly. Before we consider how accurate a test is, we first have to consider about if the test that we're going to think about using is reliable, which is to say, is it consistent? So reliability is the number one thing. I mean, number one in terms of temporal ordering. In other words, the first thing that we want to look at. First, we look at reliability, and then we can investigate the validity of a test that has a high reliability. Why is that, Dr. Fox? Because you, if let's say you decide you want to try using an IQ test, and you say, well, I have IQ test data here on this individual and that individual. I gave it to them three times, and the first time they took it, the average was a 70. The second time they took it, the average was 120. And the third time they took it, the average was 160. Something's going wrong there, right? Either they know the answers or they're sharpening up some way or the other. They're not so upset or concerned or stressed out or whatever it might happen to be. We have no consistency, and we need that consistency in order to determine if we should use the test. So if you have a bunch of different scores, you can't do that. You have to have consistency. Now, consistency is measured using what statistical process would you think? What would it be? What shows consistency across a measure? So like you have subject 1, subject 2, subject 3, test 1, test 2, test 3, and then you have scores here for each subject. This goes down to SN, whatever. How would we show consistency? That this test seems to yield the same results roughly each time. What's the statistical process? Do you want the first letter? Do you want to buy a letter? C.
Correlation.
Correlation. Yeah, good. All right. So you correlate these scores to see if there's consistency across individual scores. Right. And the generally accepted number for acceptable correlation is 0.62, by the way. Correlation runs from negative 1 to 0 to plus 1, right? And what we're looking at here is 0.62, which is a fairly consistent test. Some tests are going to be more consistent than others. If I say, well, I need somebody that's 5 feet 8 as an employee because they have to stand underneath a machine or whatever, and I use a tape measure to measure people, would that be a consistent test over time? What do you think? Come on, I know it's almost 4 o'clock on the beginning of the weekend, but would a height test be consistent?
Yes.
Yeah. When the other class, they said, well, how about if the first one was in outer space because you grow in an inch and a half in outer space? Uh-huh. That's what I said, too, but I said it in a nice way. Gee, I'd never thought of that. That is an interesting consideration. But assuming that we're all here on Earth when we do this measurement, see, I was nice about it. Whatever. Okay. So we have the idea that the height test might be consistent. Okay. And various other tests should be consistent too, including your IQ test should be consistent. If it's done in a controlled environment, same time of day, same kind of ambient sounds, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They should be consistent. About my dad. First time he took it, he got an 80. The second time he took it, he got 160. Which one do you think is the one that he thought was correct? Which one do you think I told him was the correct one? 80, of course. This went on for years, years and years. Doug kept saying, oh, it's already proven. You're dumb as a post. We know that. What do you mean? Et cetera. It's pretty funny. He's long dead, so I can laugh about it now. Anyway, so we're looking for consistency. We can help with consistency by helping to do the testing in the similar environment. But we never want to adopt a test and start using a test unless we know that it is consistent, because we won't know which score to use. Okay. So we look for consistency, and then once we have consistency, we start to see whether or not the test score, let's say it is S1, right, which was X, is that related to job performance? Question mark.
Why don't you check that before you waste the time of giving the test?
The time, there's two ways to answer that question. One of them is yes, and the other is no. See how we can help you out? That's because I have a PhD. It's easy to help you out. Yes and no. You can do a test with existing employees.
And you can do this, what's known as a concurrent test.
And a concurrent test means that you give them a test at lunch, whatever, and then you take that test score and compare it to their current what?
Job
performance, exactly. So you would take the test that we're thinking about using, that we know is consistent somehow, and we look at the relationship between that test score and their current job performance. That's called a concurrent test of validity. So, that'd be easy. Straightforward, we already have one of the measures, and the others we collect during lunchtime and give them, you know, a half an hour's pay to do it. That's easy. Okay. The bad part about this concurrent test is that the courts don't accept it. The courts don't accept this as an excuse for, let's say your test had adverse impact, and you say this test is job related, to have an excuse for using a test that's adverse impact. It's all in your notes. This is why you need to study this stuff. If you have a test that's yielding adverse impact, you're getting too many men or too many women or too many such and such, right, statistically, at 0.8, then you're going to have to prove to the court that your test is job-related. Remember, job-related is an excuse for adverse impact. Yes, Dr. Fox, we remember. Oh, yeah. Okay. But in order to do that, you're going to have a test that is proven in a better sense than concurrent methodology. Why don't they like that concurrent test? Can you see why? They want to use this test on applicants. And who are they using it on? Current employees. So the courts don't accept it. They have what's known as, they consider it to be range restricted, which is to say your data set's too small. All the poor workers have been fired. They're gone. So all you have is some good people left. The range of scores is very small, instead of having a good range to try to do a correlation with, you have restricted. So concurrent methodology is not accepted. But before I go on, I need to talk to you about this a little bit more and draw a picture or two for you to think about the hidden truth and beauty of this particular relationship that's pretty important, and most people in the street that run businesses have no look at this, though, for the time being. If this is your test out here, going this way, you can have a test scores from 1 to 100, 0 to 100, and up here will be future job performance. And that can run from 0 to, let's say, 10, whatever.
That's the future job what?
Future job performance. Job performance. P. F O R M A N. Yeah, it's okay. Sure. Job performance. And you've decided that you're going to hire anyone that scores over a 70. And that a acceptable level for job performance
is, let's just say, about 7.
So we have a 70. If they score 70 on the test, you're going to hire them. This is all sort of theory picture that helps you understand this.
Let's connect these like this. 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's numbering the quadrants. If there is no, listen up now, if there's no relationship between the test, which is called the predictor, by the way, and the criterion, which is job performance, if there's no relationship between these two variables, what's the ordered pair point pattern look like as people come in? Let's say 100 people come in and take the test and do the job, and there's no relationship between the two of them. What is, if I graph each one of those people, what's it going to look like? X, Y, right? X, comma, Y. 100 of them. And here it is. Here's that person. What's it going to look like? No relationship means what?
Scatter.
A scatter. Exactly the right word. A random scatter of ordered pair points. A random scatter of ordered pair points. Terminology is important in statistics, as most of you know. Statistics, statistics. Okay, so if I put those up here, you're 100 random points. They didn't crack. Pretty close. Okay. This random scatter of points is what you get when you have no relationship between the X and Y of all the people who applied for the job. And you gave them a work sample, this is what they did, or whatever, it doesn't matter. So, from a point of view of efficiency, what do we have here? Crap, right? And particularly, 1, 2, 3, 4, which are the crappily inefficient quadrants? Tell me why, for example, the fourth quadrant is inefficient. These are people who you didn't hire and who couldn't do the job. Is that efficient or inefficient?
Efficient.
Okay. So which ones are in, which quadrants are inefficient? One, because you hired them and their work wasn't very good. So this is an inefficient quadrant. Where's the other inefficient quadrant? Three, because you didn't hire them and they could have done the job. So this is another inefficient quadrant right here. And interestingly enough, since there's no correlation between the test and the job performance, numerically, R equals what? Sample R equals
zero.
And isn't it interesting that's what the shape is here? I've always thought that was kind of fun. It's, you know, a zero. Right? No relationship. How do we make this graph more efficient? Come on. When I say more efficient, I want all 100 people to be in the efficient quadrants, right? Obviously. So how do I do that? By increasing what? Say? No, it's a numerical answer. It's a number answer. Increase what?
Quadrant 2 and 4.
I can't hear you.
Quadrant 2 and 4.
Yes, but how am I going to get everybody into these quadrants? How am I going to get them all to fit onto this quadrant? That was a big hint there. What? Make the test more highly correlated. Precisely. Because a perfect correlation is going to form not a circle, but rather a
line.
The gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous line that we all so deeply want. Right? We want a line right here. We want to change that ugly circle into a line. And we do that by increasing the correlation between the test and future job performance by finding a test that is indeed highly correlated with future job performance. All right. Before we go any further,
my wife would always correct me one way or the other.
Don't forget, since we have that down there, we can have negative correlation too.
Which would be that you would hire people who, what? You would hire people who are where?
Low.
Who are low numbered. For example, how many times were you absent in your last job over the last 2 years? If a guy says, I was absent 85 times, he's going to be way out here, his job performance is going to be low. Got it? All right. So negative is useful too. Positive and negative, as long as it's a line. Are you ever going to get a line? Correlation of one on a selection test? The answer is clearly no. But you're going to get something that's at least, you know, sort of like football shape, I guess, which is what they call a linear trend. So we see a linear trend between these variables. And it's important to remember this in your mind. From the point, if you get anything out of all of this, is to be sure to understand the value of eliminating the inefficiency of a non-correlated test. Right? And probably most companies now are using tests that are next to non-correlated. Just to stretch theory a little bit farther, just to stretch the theory a little bit further, if this test is an R of 0, at what point does the test become more useful? We know 0 has absolutely no use. At what point does it begin to have some use, or any use?
450.
That would be the idea of consistency. So we don't go there. Think about it from the point of view of what you're seeing in this picture. Changing that circle, how much makes it more useful? The first word will be any. Any amount of change away from 0 is useful. Do you see my point? Because you no longer have a random scatter, you're beginning to get some order. So order is important here. So even a test that has a miserable 0.2 or 0.1 correlation is useful. Check this out. In the dissertation I did, I was working with garment sewers in West Jefferson. They were sewing uniforms for contract sewing for all the big chains, Burger King, all the big colon cancer centers. All right, so what we have here was sewing uniforms. They had a test that had no correlation. It was whether or not they knew you from church and whether or not you knew what was a sewing machine versus a car. And if you could do that, then you were hired. Okay, I created a test for them that involved a bunch of stuff, including the MBTI and a few other things. I ended up at a 0.32. Doesn't seem very wonderful, but I showed them how a 0.32 versus a 0 increased company profits by 10%. That was sweet. That's a huge change in money. Major change. I mean, their profit was really 10%, so basically they're going to double their profit. Pretty good. I know. Happens every class. So what are you going to do with this thing? Are you going to go with this 0.32? Sure you're going to go with it. 10% is better than nothing percent, and so what we're seeing here is an increasing value as this number goes up. But that's not to say that all the way down here to 0.01 isn't useful. Of course, you have to weigh it against how long it takes to give the test, and is there a cost to using a test, and blah, 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 blah. But at least from the point of view of the relationship, it's a value. Anything that isn't zero random is a value. Don't forget, okay? It's important. All right, so we're going to then try to create a test that has a high validity after we've established that it already has a high consistency. Everybody with me? All right. I know this is the dreaded statistics, and if somebody says to you, are you mathematically inclined, your response is going to be, I'm mathematically reclined. I understand all of that. None of this stuff comes easy. But if you get this picture in your brain, you're going to be way advantaged over the average schmo on the street that doesn't know his elbow from a hole in the ground. Because this stuff really gives you a picture to burn into your mind to encourage you to try to find selection tools like I'm going to tell you about. I'm standing away from the door, which I'm going to tell you about next time. It's going to stampede, so I had to move away from the door. All right.
Yes, Doctor.